So what can you think of as an example from the Bible of times when it seemed as if the true people of God were very much in the minority, and that either the false people, those who claimed to be the people of God, were in the majority, or those who just were God's enemies appeared to be the majority? So I guess kind of what I'm thinking of is the idea of a remnant. A remnant means a small piece or a small portion of the original. And very often it does seem as if God works through a small portion of the larger group, whatever that larger group may be. Even within Israel, there were many times when there was a great apostasy, and yet there was this smaller remnant. So can you think of some examples from the Bible when there's this smaller remnant sort of reality going on? Yes. Okay, so really, when it comes to the whole period of exile, there is kind of a remnant reality. And so there's this group over in Babylon, some of whom have kind of accept Babylonian ways, others of whom, like Esther, and then we could include Daniel in that, and others who have a faithful approach to the things of God and are faithful to their calling. Even at the same time, while Esther is married to a pagan king. You know, she stays true. She stays faithful to God. J.L. Sisera. Yes. So that would have been Deborah and Barak. And then J.L. is the one who put the tent peg through. Yeah. Somebody else? Greg? Yeah, Noah. It's like really super obvious. It's like eight people are preserved out of the entire human race at the time. So there's just had been an obvious decline in godliness, and Noah represents a much smaller remnant. Yeah. Anybody else? Throughout the book of Genesis, there is kind of a contrast between the line of Cain and the line of Seth. Seth being a godly line, the line through which all the promises came, the line from which Abraham came. And so there was this, you know, somewhat smaller, sometimes weaker group. Any from the New Testament? Go ahead. The early church is kind of small. Sure, it does grow exponentially, but yes, it starts out very small. I think really we should think of the disciples. How many tribes are there in Israel? How many disciples are there? 12. Okay, Jesus even calls attention to that and promises the disciples that in the judgment, the 12 disciples will sit upon thrones and judge the 12 tribes of Israel. The 12 disciples, in many ways, are a remnant replacement of Israel. They are the true Israel because they are the ones who have believed upon their Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. And so the disciples really represent that small remnant. And the best illustration of that really is John chapter 6. John chapter 6, Jesus feeds the 5,000 plus, right? The 5,000 men plus women and children. And then the people clamor for breakfast and then for lunch again, you know, and they chase him around the lake and they want, Jesus says to them, you didn't even come to see the miracles. You just came to eat. And by the end of that chapter, Jesus asks, will you go away also? And Jesus says, to whom shall we go? Because only you have the words of life. They didn't want the bread for their bellies. They wanted the words of life for their souls. Peter recognized that it was their spiritual hunger and thirst that drove them to Christ and kept them with Christ even when he became unpopular. So, yes, there is definitely a remnant reality kind of going on, even in the ministry of Christ, as the group gets smaller and smaller and smaller. At the end of chapter 6, it says that only the 12 remained with him, and one of them was a devil, because it was Judas, of course. All right. Well, go ahead. There's some history going on there, certainly. The problem is the majority of them don't believe in Christ. So, you know, we're wrestling with that comparison, but God may have yet for them plans of them being a part of the remnant. Yeah. So, let me just say that has continued beyond the Scriptures, and that as we look at some things over the next couple of weeks, what I want us to do is to look at what some people call the proto-Reformation or the pre-Reformation, and just see how before the Protestant Reformation, before things exploded with Luther, Zwingli, and Calvin, there were people who were bucking against the power and the corruption and the error of the medieval Catholic Church. And we will see that they go back a pretty long way. They go back to at least the 1100s, those who were bucking against that. And I think that as we've studied, and it's been a little awkward a little bit for us as Protestants to kind of study history that seemed very Catholic for several centuries, right? But as we've kind of dived down into some of the details of that European medieval Catholic history, we've seen that some of the characteristics of Catholicism didn't really take root until almost this time, until almost the turn of the millennium with the year 1000 or even beyond. So there were priests who had wives for many centuries beyond what we would have perhaps expected. There were those who the doctrine of transubstantiation was not sort of ratified by the power of the Pope and councils until the 1200s. And so it was there, but it wasn't ratified as official doctrine, so it wasn't held by everybody. And so we kind of see that even as things are declining, God is raising up what we would think of as a remnant to represent Him as the true people of God. So someone had asked me, where were the true people of God throughout these long centuries of error and corruption? And the first answer is, well, some of them were within the organized Catholic Church. They were just faithful believers who kind of rolled their eyes and went with it, right? Or maybe didn't roll their eyes, but, you know, they just kind of went with it, but they understood the gospel and may have been in error about many other things as well. I mean, you can be saved and still think that priests shouldn't have a wife. I mean, that's kind of a secondary issue, right? Could be a Christian. But nevertheless, so there were some true believers within the organized church, and then there were some rebels out here as well, who, again, are kind of a mixed bag, but nevertheless held to the true gospel. But before we get to that, I want to just say a couple of things about colonial expansion in the Catholic Church. So you can look at those bullet points ahead of the little map there, and then we'll talk about the map. So Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, right? And he discovers the Americas. On his way back, he was sailing under which flag? The Spanish flag, okay? If I remember correctly, he himself was Portuguese, but he was sailing for Ferdinand and Isabella under the Spanish flag. But on his way home, he stopped off and talked to the King of Portugal. So his true colors come out, right? And he stops off and speaks to him. And he begins to claim the... he wants some claim to the colonial lands as well. So the Spanish appeal to the Pope, who is himself at the time a Spaniard. And in 1493, the Pope issues a papal bull or edict granting all non-Christian lands west of a certain line, and you can see that line, dotted line, there that's out by South America there, anything west of that would belong to Spain, and it would be their colonial territory. So this effectively cut Portugal out of the Americas, except for that tiny little portion, especially if you're referring to that dotted line, that tiny little portion of Brazil. So then the Portuguese begin to negotiate with the Pope and with directly with Ferdinand and Isabella, and eventually they change the line of demarcation, and it says that they get a little bit more, as you can see there, and of course that also means that Portugal gets all of Africa and Asia. So Spain gets the Americas essentially, and Portugal gets Africa and Asia. And that was in 1494. Now, let's talk for just a moment about colonialism and the Catholic Church. At the same time that the Reformation is just beginning, so 1492 is only a few years before 1517, which is the beginning of the Reformation under Martin Luther in Germany. So that colonial period is just beginning. Ships are going back and forth across the Atlantic. And so at the same time that the Reformation is rocking Europe, I mean literally, spiritually, politically, militarily, everything, as at the same time that Europe is being rocked by the Reformation, colonialism is expanding the Catholic Church more than it has ever expanded before in its history by taking Catholicism primarily to the Americas and to some smaller degree to India and even all the way to Japan. The Catholic Church is expanding much greater, multiplying really, at a much greater rate than it ever has before. And so these Spanish and Portuguese colonists, they take Catholic missionaries with them. Most of these missionaries were monks, either Franciscan or Dominican monks, or they were Jesuit priests. However, these missionaries were often complicit with some of the primary and worst atrocities of the colonial period. And so they either stood idly by and did not call the colonists to account for decimating and enslaving the indigenous people groups, so those people groups that were already there in primarily South and Central America. These missionaries also were around and did not call the people to account or even participated in the African slave trade, as well as the invasion of native lands and the exploitation of natural resources. So the colonists really carried out many atrocities. Okay, I mean, think, what do we know about Cortez? Okay, and there were missionaries that either were with him or followed shortly after him, and so consequently, these missionaries kind of besmirched the name of Christ by their participation in or their complicity in these atrocities. This made indigenous people groups suspicious of missionaries, but there were some notable exceptions to these exploits, I'm just going to tell the story of one of them. So I'm not really wanting to spend a lot of time on this, but I want to just give us one example. So Pedro Claver was born in 1580, and he decided to join the Jesuits and become a missionary fairly early in his life. He ended up going to Colombia, and once he arrived at Colombia, he was very distressed by the suffering that he saw, and these were the constantly arriving African slaves. So you know the story of African slavery. It didn't just happen in the North American colonies. It happened just as much in the South American colonies. and sometimes to even worse effects. So working in the sugarcane industry or the sugar plantations was just as bad as cotton plantations, and in some cases much worse. By the way, I know that I end up recommending movies maybe a little too often, but how many of you guys have seen the movie Amazing Grace? It has it is about John Newton and William Pitt and William Wilberforce. It's really about William Wilberforce. So if you have not seen that, it is about the African slave trade being banned in England. And it is a beautiful story, and it is connecting. There's even some footage that kind of shows some of the horrors of not North American plantations, but South American plantations and the sugar plantations in Central and South America. So there were constantly arriving slaves. Some of them would arrive dead. They were cramped. It was really quite terrible. They were taken from the holds of the slave ships and basically put in cages. And so he would go to those cages, and he and his fellow missionaries would pull out the dead bodies, because the slaves had no way of getting the dead bodies out of the cages that they were kept in. So they would take those dead bodies out so that diseases wouldn't spread. They would give these slaves water and fresh fruit. He also organized a system of providing for them with ongoing food and clothing. So he really ran a mission society for the specific benefit of these slaves. Because of the many illnesses, some of them would get leprosy. He started a leprosarium. He also would dress the sores of those who had succumbed to smallpox. In fact, he was one of the very few that would come close enough to take care of those with smallpox. And he would also preach to them. And he was, apparently, he was fairly good at it. He would use illustrations. One of the illustrations that he would use was that just like a snake would shed its old skin, that Christians shed the old nature and receive a new nature in the Lord Jesus Christ. I mean, theologically, he may not have been very precise, because we do still have our old nature, but he's talking about the new nature of a Christian, and he's using that as an illustration. He's giving them water, and he would say, and again, theologically, we don't agree with this, but he would say that this water quenches your physical thirst, but the waters of baptism quench spiritual thirst. And of course, it's not the waters of baptism, but it's the living water of the Spirit of God that quenches our thirst. But he would preach to them rather effectively and with these, simple illustrations that really captivated the people. He would go and sit among the slaves, and he would sit on the ground, because all of the slaves had to sit on the ground. And as far as he was concerned, they didn't need to hear him. They needed to hear the interpreter anyway. So the interpreter would sit on a chair. Everybody else would be on the ground, and he would preach to them through that interpreter. Eventually, he actually convinced his monastery to purchase several slaves that would serve as just, sort of ongoing interpreters for him. But that caused strife among his European fellow monks who were prejudiced against Africans. And so he is really reaching out and ministering to these black slaves. He never openly criticized the whites in the colony there, because he knew that they could crush his ministry, they could stop him. But on the street, he would only speak to blacks and slaves and the few whites who supported him. And so he was distinguishing, what he thought was important by doing these things. And also, of course, as a Catholic, he had to hear confession. But he would not hear confession of wealthy white people. He only heard confession from slaves, from the poor, and from children. At the end of his life, he was struck with a paralysis. And his fellow Jesuits, who never apparently really liked him much anyway, entrusted him to a slave that they knew to be cruel. And at the end of his life, he suffered very much similarly to the ways that a slave would have suffered in the hold of a slave ship, because they couldn't move because they were constrained by chains. He couldn't move because of paralysis, and no one would clean him. No one would care for him because this slave was so cruel. At the very end of his life, the people began to recognize, all of these wealthy white people began to recognize that he was rather saintly in his outreach to African slaves, and they began to visit him. So I assume at that time he received a bit more care. But they took away all of his stuff. They, as these sort of superstitious type Catholics, would want relics from someone that they thought might become a saint, and eventually the Catholic Church did call this, they sainted him. I can't remember what it's called, but anyway, they made him a saint, and so they took away his stuff. They took away his crucifix. They took away his belongings, and his fellow Jesuits made him say yes to all of these requests that were made of him. So quite a story, but someone who stood up for the rights of slaves and others. So any comments or questions about kind of this general period of time and how colonialism really expanded the global outreach of the Catholic Church, while at the same time, there's really sort of an earthquake-like schism in the Catholic Church going on in Europe? Yeah, Heather? Yes, it is. That's important to remember. And sometimes in a period of history like our own, all anybody really does in the public realm is remember how terrible Christians have been, right? We started the Crusades and we were complicit in slavery or whatever else. And the Spanish Inquisition and other things. And so it is important to remember that much good has been done in the name of Christ. Well, I should have pointed out that, they redrew the line. So the solid line, represents what they eventually got a year later in 1494. And then there was a lot of conflict. I didn't go into this. There was a lot of conflict between the Spanish and the Portuguese. And so the Portuguese had to keep moving inland, because as the Spanish would come and they would fight battles, the Portuguese had to keep moving inland just for safety's sake, so they spread the Portuguese language. Yeah. Yeah, Mark.
On your map, there's another one.
On the other side. I don't really know what that is. There was another treaty. In 1529, and so of course the world is round, right? And so really what you see on that side of the map is still considered to be west of the line that goes down through Brazil. And so the Spanish, held claim to that. To that small portion of Australia. So there needed to be two lines that put a limit on the Portuguese. And of course, that treaty isn't very important. We can see how influential Spain has been in Central and South America. That's obvious to the point that the current Pope is from Argentina, okay? Wow, I was going to say something else, but I knew it. Okay, so, that is a direct result of this history that we've just talked about, okay? However, when it comes to Africa, the British and the Dutch and the Portuguese and everybody got involved in Africa, and of course the British, the French, and a little bit of the Spanish are involved in North America. So after a while, everybody ignored what the Pope said in 1493 and just went for it. But there was some demarcation, putting a limit on what was supposedly the Portuguese colonial area, and that's what that right-hand line is. Yeah, I mean, the Protestant Reformation happened, so after 1517, half the countries of Northern Europe didn't care what the Pope said, right? He can draw lines on the map all he wants. We're sailing, you know. So, all right, anything else on that sort of colonial period? All right, now let's look at these sort of remnant movements that predate the Reformation. And again, in the textbook that I'm using, this is referred to as the quest for Reformation, the quest for Reformation. So let's talk about the Waldensians. Also, there's other names for them. Peter Waldo was from Lyons, France. And so there's a number of different pronunciations, more French kinds of pronunciations. But Waldensians, also known as Waldenses, and several other possible pronunciations. They were a group of Christians started by Peter Waldo in around 1173. And sometimes it's kind of hard to separate legend from fact regarding Peter Waldo and, you know, all of the beginnings of this kind of movement. But here are some of the broad themes. So here we go. Those are the smaller bullet points. Starting with Peter Waldo was a citizen of Lyons. He renounced his wealth, and he bequeathed his wealth to family members, including his wife. And I am unsure kind of how this went down, but some of these groups would allow their married members to pursue a monastic lifestyle. Some of them were allowed to pursue a monastic lifestyle with the permission of their spouse. And some of them were allowed to pursue even if their spouse did not get permission, did not give permission. So this would be like a religious divorce almost. I mean, it's this kind of, you think, you know, these guys didn't necessarily get it all right either. And that's not a biblical thing to abandon your spouse for holy vows, quote unquote. But nevertheless, he did bequeath part of his wealth to his wife, and then I don't know what happened to her. Did they continue to live as husband and wife, or did he just move on out and do his ministry? So he sort of renounces his wealth and bequeaths it to various people. The majority of it was given to the poor. But he saw his wealth as a hindrance to his preaching ministry. So do you remember us talking about mendicant monks? They were begging monks who went out among the people and preached. Well, I'm not sure what they preached, okay, but they preached, all right. And so he would have been like one of them, a sort of a begging kind of preacher who made his living by doing the preaching as opposed to having, you know, kind of a steady income of inherited wealth. Consequently, the Waldensians were first known as the Poor of Lyons. Waldo was committed to lay preaching, to poverty, and to strict adherence to the Bible. And then sometime between 1775 and 1785, he either commissioned some clerics to translate the Bible into the local language, which would have been French, or some version of French, some dialect, early dialect of French, whatever the local language would have been at the time. And then he, or he was possibly involved in the translation himself. Peter Waldo and an associate at one point were called to Rome to defend their beliefs before a council. Their teachings were eventually condemned by the Third Lateran Council. They were excommunicated and condemned as heretics a short time later. So, as far as we know, Peter Waldo, we don't really know how he died. He may have died in battle. He may have died as a martyr. He may have died of natural causes. We don't really know the circumstances of his death, but he had, after the excommunication, he had to leave the city of Lyons, and he had to go up into the Alps. So we've all heard reference to, you know, there's the French Alps, the Swiss Alps, and the Italian Alps. He went up into the Alps there from his village in France and really had to survive. He and his followers had to survive in the high valleys of the Alps. Now, here are some of the things that they taught or some of the things that they rejected. This is where we would say that they have Reformation-like beliefs. Preachers should not hold civil office. So this would be common with those who followed John Wycliffe as well in England. But the idea simply was that there was just way too many preachers who were also holding civil offices and just becoming rich. And so corruption was entering the church, entering the Catholic Church through one of those ways. Relics, they taught that relics were just a bunch of old rotten bones, and who knows whose bones they were. They taught that pilgrimage did nothing to serve you spiritually. They only served to empty your purse. People should eat meat on whatever day they so desired. So even today, Catholics, some strict Catholics, only will eat fish on Fridays, and their precursors of that were already happening. So he's basically said, eat beef, pork, whatever you want, whenever you want, you know. And then he taught that holy water was no more holy than rainwater. You can kind of get the colorfulness of the way he would say things along the way. He said that praying in a barn was just as effective as praying in a church. They were accused of denying the doctrine of transubstantiation. It's hard to know. A lot of this is folklore, kind of, just passed down verbally and not necessarily their history. Their history is written down, but only by the Catholics that hated them. Okay, so we don't know necessarily how they might have presented themselves. They were also accused of referring to the Roman Catholic Church as the harlot of Revelation. They rejected the idolatry of the Roman Catholic worship, and they considered the Pope to be the Antichrist. So, that sounds pretty, pretty much like Reformation to us, right? And we will talk about why was the Reformation under Luther and others successful, and these essentially were not, and it really has to do more with politics. Nobody would protect these people, whereas Luther had someone to protect him and hide him when it was most important, and had a strong enough army to fight against anybody that came against him there in Germany. So now, again, as I've already mentioned, the Waldensians were excommunicated in 1184. They were condemned as heretics in 1210. And then in 1211, 80 Waldensians were burned at the stake. And that began several centuries of persecution that almost wiped them out. Once the Reformation began, however, the Waldensians met with some Reformed leaders. And they would be people that... one of the names was Farrell that met with him. So that's fairly well known. I kind of am familiar with that name from the history of the Reformation. So some fairly well-known Reformation leaders were sent to meet with them. They decided to join the Reformation, and they began to worship openly after the Reformation. So they also, after the Reformation, they paid for part of the publication of a newly translated French Bible, which I think probably Calvin was involved in translating it, but they paid for part of the publication. However, because France remained Catholic even after the Reformation, they persecuted them. They continued to persecute them. So they didn't really have religious freedom until after the French Revolution, much later. So they were continued to be persecuted in 1655. So this is well after the Reformation has taken root in the rest of Europe. In 1655, the Waldensians were given a choice by the king. It was either to attend a mass or move back into the Alps, up into the high valleys. And they were expected, because it was wintertime, they basically thought that they would capitulate, but they didn't. And they, with their women and children and elderly, they tromped through ice and snow, had to break through the ice on rivers and wade through icy, frozen water, freezing water, to get up into the Alps. Some of the people of the Waldensians had never left the Alps, and so they went and they were welcomed by these people. They start to settle in back in sort of their refuge, so to speak. But they were forced to then billet the soldiers, and which was not a good thing, okay, because they obeyed the commandment of the king, and they billeted the soldiers. What they didn't know that there was going to be a signal, and that signal came on April the 5th, 1655 at 4 a.m., and there was a horrible massacre. 1,500 Waldensians were killed in some of the most horrible kinds of ways. Children were bashed, you know, their heads were bashed against the wall. Women were raped. People were, poles were stuck up through the middle of them to kill them, and just horrifying ways in which these people were brutally, brutally massacred. However, this massacre sparked outrage among various Protestant rulers all over Europe. This was during the Commonwealth period in England. So Oliver Cromwell himself called for a fast in England over their plight, the Waldensians' plight. He wrote letters, he raised money, and he threatened to send military force to rescue them. I just had a thought that in some ways Oliver Cromwell was sort of the English version of Donald Trump. He just did what he wanted to. Off with the king's head. We're going to invade France so that we can rescue the Waldensians. You know, he really had that kind of personality. And so he made threats that very well could have been carried out, although they were not. And during that time, some Waldensians came to the United States. They immigrated to the United States, and some went up to England and kind of found safety in these other Reformation lands, as well as other Reformation lands of Europe as well. And so I've already said, you know, because France and Italy remained Catholic, after the Reformation, these Waldensians continued to experience persecution well into the 1800s, and they received their full religious freedom after the French Revolution. But they did become pretty tough to defeat. They accepted some of the characteristics of guerrilla warfare. So what would happen is the French government would send people in to inhabit their villages. And they would go up into the mountains, and then they would come out of the mountains and drive those people back out. And that happened kind of repeatedly. And they were pretty hard to whip. Militarily, they learned to defend themselves valiantly in battle and also use these guerrilla warfare tactics to retake their villages again and again and again. All right, so that's the Waldensians. They are the oldest of these groups. Wycliffe and Huss come along later, but we probably know more about them because they come along later and because both Wycliffe and Huss wrote. We will take them up next time. Any comments or questions? It's fun to think about these remnant people who were holding the standard of truth, or at least kicking against the errors of the Catholic Church long before Martin Luther. Any comments or questions about this? All right. One final thing, and I'll try to repeat this. There is a little booklet, and there is an entire movement, and it has sort of a formal. I just remembered it. It's called Landmark Baptists. Some people will teach that the Waldensians were this long thread of Baptist people, that always Baptists, always baptized converts and never baptized infants, okay? And the booklet is called Trail of Blood, and it is put out by people who believe in this. It's called Landmark Baptists, and they're trying to prove that there is a continual trail of blood all the way from the disciples, Jesus and the disciples, all the way to the Anabaptist movement, which would then have led to the Baptists in England and in other countries, that is very much a part of our heritage. Well, there's several historical problems with that, and there is no evidence that the Waldensians practiced adult baptism or convert baptism or believer's baptism. We don't know what they practiced necessarily, but it's kind of historically not viable to say that kind of continued all the way through. I think that believer's baptism is something that was dropped and then later recovered by people who first went through the Reformation and then kind of what some people call the Baptist insight that wait a minute, we probably shouldn't be baptizing our babies and telling them they're Christians anymore. So that came really came after the Reformation. All right. You're dismissed.